Hello, Connecticut, and welcome to the Paid Leave Podcast. The title basically says it all. I'm Nancy Barrow, and I will be delving into this new state program and how it can help you and your family. This podcast will give you information you should know about Connecticut paid leave and maybe just a little bit more. Connecticut paid leave brings peace of mind to your home, family, and workplace. Welcome to the Paid Leave Podcast. Today, we're talking about rare diseases. February 29th, which is leap year, is Rare Disease Day, which is an observance to raise awareness for rare disease and improve access to treatment and medical representation for individuals with rare diseases and their families. Over 300 million people across the world are affected by a rare disease. In the United States, about 30 million are affected by rare diseases. According to the National Institute of Health, this equals to about 1 in 10 Americans affected, or 1 on every elevator, or 4 on every bus. The problem with rare diseases is even getting a diagnosis. Then they have to use a treatment or create a treatment, or you may be lucky enough to get into a clinical trial. All these things can take you away from your job if you're a caregiver. And it's really hard to be there for a loved one and be there for your job as well. And that's where Connecticut paid leave can help. It gives qualifying workers up to 12 weeks of income replacement to take care of your own serious health condition or that of a loved one. And there are three types of leave. There is the block leave, where you can take all 12 weeks at once, or intermittent leave to go to doctor's appointments. And there's reduced schedule leave. Maybe you work half days because you need to get treatments in the afternoon or more testing. So there is flexibility with Connecticut paid leave. And if you're taking care of a loved one, you're a caregiver. And that doesn't mean you have to be a blood relative. It can be a family connection that we call related by affinity. And it's expanded definition of family. So a best friend or a coworker or a partner if you aren't married. It can help you take time away from work to get tested for a diagnosis and for treatment, and you can get up to 12 weeks in a calendar year. This also covers mental health and addiction treatments. And of course, many rare diseases may be a chronic condition, and of course, we would cover appointment treatments and flare-ups with those. Joining me today is Rich Horgan. His background is in business and he has an MBA. He is the founder and CEO of Cure Rare Disease. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. Really happy and excited to have the opportunity to share more about rare disease with the folks listening today.
And before we get into the science and the financials of rare disease and your company that blends them all together, let's start with the basics. Rich, can you tell me what a rare disease is?
Rare disease, as you've alluded to and started to dive into, is a bit of a misnomer, I would say. Rare disease, in fact, collectively is not rare at all. As you pointed out, it impacts about 10% of Americans. Taken in aggregate, this is more people impacted than diabetes, than breast cancer, than some of the biggest, most known, I should say, diseases that we come across in our daily life. Almost everybody knows somebody that's been touched by cancer. The same canon should be said for rare disease. And so rare disease itself is defined as a disease that impacts 200,000 or less Americans. This is the definition that the United States uses. Europe has a slightly different definition, but since we're here in the States, we'll focus on the States. Rare disease is challenged by a number of things. It's individually, these diseases are quite rare, but when you look at clinicians who treat diseases, they often don't encounter individual rare diseases very often. And so there's this challenge around the diagnostic odyssey. How do we get a definitive diagnosis for the rare disease? When your PCP or your primary care physician generally sees things like high blood pressure, heart disease, high cholesterol. The nuance of a rare disease such as cystic fibrosis or ALS or Duchenne muscular dystrophy is often not the first thing they think of. And therein lies the challenge associated with, part of the challenge anyway, associated with rare disease. And really, the definition of rare disease is one in which allows drug developers to, in some cases, get the FDA to expedite review of a potential drug candidate in clinical trials. Mm. Things like pediatric rare disease, pediatric vouchers, for instance, are tools that are used to incentivize drug development to occur for these rare diseases. Because individually, you know, as we discussed, they're rare. And so the market is smaller than diabetes, is smaller individually for these diseases than heart disease. And so years ago, the government put into place these incentives to try to get drug development more focused on rare diseases.
And how long can it take to diagnose a rare disease?
So the diagnostic odyssey is very variable for rare disease. It comes down to what the rare disease is. So some of the quote unquote more common rare diseases like a cystic fibrosis, like a Duchenne muscular dystrophy, are a little bit more well known. You have the backing of insurance companies to do a newborn screening, for instance. And so this may be picked up prior to the birth of the child. Other rare diseases, however, don't have such an advantage. Some rare diseases don't even have a name. They're identified by things like a gene code, for instance, like, for instance, ADSSL1. You know, this is a disease that impacts about one in a million people. And so it doesn't benefit from the inclusion of newborn screening for a number of reasons. But on average, to answer your question, the diagnostic odyssey for rare disease patients is about 5 years. This 5 years is a crushing number of doctor's visits, often starting with a primary care physician and then often evolving into a number of specialists, often marred by misdiagnoses that are too myopic in nature. You know, I can give you the example of Duchenne muscular dystrophy, where, you know, patients will, young boys, which it almost exclusively affects, are often first characterized by meeting or missing growth milestones, characterized by an abnormal gait. And so taken individually, these things don't immediately point to Duchenne muscular dystrophy. They point to, maybe it's just a delayed growth. You know, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And so when you eventually, you know, as those five, three, however number of years pass, 7 years pass, you start to see the manifestation of more symptoms. And as the manifestation of more symptoms occurs, then oftentimes clinicians will be able to put the dots together to say, oh, it's not just delayed growth. It's not just abnormal gait. There's, you know, increased muscle weakness. There's toe walking, things like this. There's an elevated creatine kinase level. And so put together, then the diagnosis becomes a little bit more obvious, but that takes time. And so one of the advantages of newborn screening is that you can pick it up before the child is born. Mm-hmm. But for the vast majority of rare diseases, this doesn't exist right now. And that's really what leads to the diagnosis period being so long.
Why don't we talk about your company and how it got started and your inspiration for your company? It's your brother, Terry. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Terry and his story?
Sure. So Terry was born with a disease called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. DMD, as it's abbreviated, is a muscle wasting disease that's progressive in nature. And so there's no effective treatment or cure to DMD. And like rare disease at large, the challenge with DMD is that the individual, the patient population is very heterogeneous. And so one patient will manifest the disease at a different rate than another patient will manifest the disease. Some patients are impacted by intellectual disabilities, OCD, ADHD, neurological challenges. Mm-hmm. All patients will be impacted by muscle weakness. The cause of death for these patients is ultimately cardiopulmonary failure. The heart is a muscle, the diaphragm with which you breathe is a muscle. And so it's a really challenging disease. Most patients are diagnosed in their early years, generally around 3 to 5 years of age. As the disease progresses, they lose the ability to walk around the age of 10-ish. Again, these patients are very variable, so it is not a one-size-fits-all diagnosis.
Yeah.
Ultimately, cardiopulmonary problems start to manifest in the early teenagers. And most of these patients succumb to the disease in their second or third decade of life. And so it's a really brutal disease. And I found myself and my family found ourselves in a situation where Terry had a diagnosis, but nothing to do about it. The few clinical trials that existed at the time didn't accept him. Clinical trials are notoriously very, very difficult to enroll in. The clinical trial picks the patient. The patient doesn't pick the clinical trial. And so I formed a collaboration of researchers and clinicians in the late 2010s to develop a therapeutic to try to reverse the disease that was robbing him of life.
How did you... You say it really casually, but I can't imagine that that was an easy process. You know, how did you pick your researchers? Where did you find this? And did you have, you know, being an MBA, did you have a business plan that you set in front of yourself for the structure of what you wanted to get something that would help your brother?
It certainly wasn't as linear as I've summarized. I think a big degree of work that goes into any initiative like this is talking to a lot of doctors, of researchers, of drug developers, of really forming the network to understand what's going on, who's who, how do you develop a drug? And so, yeah, as you pointed out, my background is not drug development. Prior to business school, I worked at an advanced manufacturing company. And so I used my time in business school to develop that network, going to conferences, developing relationships with scientists, with clinicians, and just building a presence in the field. So by the time I was done with business school, I had a pretty solid working knowledge of who's who. And I had a pretty solid working knowledge of who are the collaborative folks in the field, who might make for good collaborators in such an initiative. And it started small, you know, it started with a few collaborators, and as our progress advanced, grew into more collaborators. At the time, the initiative focused primarily in the Northeast. So with Yale as the group that developed the technology, we worked with Charles River Labs, which is a contract research organization that helped us to do some of the preclinical testing. And then we ended up manufacturing the drug in the US as well. And then ultimately, the clinical trial took place in Massachusetts.
You got a drug approved for him to try, and it got approved by the FDA. I think that's remarkable.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It wasn't me, though, at the end of the day. You know, I brought the scientists together. I brought the researchers and the clinicians together. I brought the community together. It was very much so the team that got the drug approved by the FDA. It was our scientists at Yale, at Charles River, our regulatory people, our manufacturing people, who really paved the way. It was a lot of members of the Connecticut community. We have an annual golf tournament and dinner in the shoreline. And, you know, I would say the Connecticut community is unlike really any other community I've come across. They're a very passionate and dedicated group of people that, you know, want to make the world a better place. And it's a really unique thing that isn't at all everywhere else in the US or broadly.
Genetics play a really big part in some of these rare diseases. And you had other family members that had this disease as well. Is there a test that you can do to find out if you're a carrier or anything like that for this particular disease?
So we talked a little bit about newborn screening a few minutes ago. That is just emerging, like as we speak. Several states are starting to bring that online. Genetic testing is not 100%. So there are misses associated with genetic testing. And so, you know, nowadays there is increasingly newborn screening. At the time, though, there was no such thing. Which makes it all the more challenging. And so I think, you know, that's an important aspect of newborn screening, is you're able to know earlier than when the disease would manifest. And it's something that's really important for states to adopt, is the idea of newborn screening.
Yeah, I think as you learn more about these rare diseases, maybe there's a better protocol for them.
Yeah, I think it's like anything, right? I think as more progress is made, we understand more. We understand more patients are impacted than was traditionally thought. There's any plethora of rare diseases that, you know, at first we thought it was one in a million, and it turns out it's one in 10,000 or something like that. And so, you know, I think there's no centralized effort to screen newborns. It's very much so a disaggregated effort, a state-by-state effort. And so a lot of things are missed in that, a lot of understanding of population dynamics. You know, when you look at the United Kingdom, they have one of the largest, you know, efforts underway to screen residents in the United Kingdom. And so more data is just better in general to identify disease prevalence and how common or uncommon a disease truly is. And that prevalence ties to incentivizing drug development. So the more prevalent, the more serious a disease is, the more effort generally goes into it to try to solve it. When you look at the Alzheimer's epidemic, I guess you could call it, you know, Alzheimer's impacts a lot of Americans, and that is a very deadly, very debilitating disease that although not rare by any means, it warrants significant development. The pressure it puts on the American economy, then on society, on the patients and the caregivers and the families who are impacted, it's really devastating.
But there's a lot of other diseases that don't have that attention because it doesn't affect as many people. So the challenges there are you have to rely on the scientists to help you. And then if they help you, it costs money. So how do you get the money if, because you're a nonprofit organization?
So science costs money. I mean, that's just a fact of life. It's not a good fact. It's not a bad fact. It is a fact. And so, you know, I think at the end of the day, we approach this from the angle of being a nonprofit because there are diseases that are not commercializable. Diseases like we talked about, like ADSSL1, where there's one in a million patients and, you know, geez, a market of a couple hundred patients is not sufficient enough for the way that commercial entities develop drugs. And that's not a good thing. That's not a bad thing. Again, that's just a fact of life. So we raise awareness. You know, we raise awareness through conversations like these. We raise support through events like we have on the shoreline. We have that every September. We increasingly have events across the United States, in Texas and California and other states where, you know, individuals are impacted by these diseases and they want to make the world a better place. And that is how you change things. Being involved, being engaged, change is very much so incremental. It's not like you see in the movies. There's not this like aha moment of I've discovered the cure and, you know, all else sort of falls into place. This science is a grind. Science is two steps forward, three steps back in a lot of cases, but those three steps back teach us things like what works, what doesn't work, and what knowing what works, but also what doesn't work is important and informative. And so, you know, people ask like, why focus on rare disease? Why not focus on Alzheimer's? Not to us, but broadly the question is that the learnings that we accumulate and gather through developing therapeutics for smaller populations very much so inform the development for larger populations. Mm. And so these clinical trials are really the thing that matters. And oftentimes clinical trials aren't full reversal of the disease. This isn't like a silver bullet. This is incremental improvement. This is, you know, in the case of, we'll use Duchenne muscular dystrophy again. In the case of DMD, this is, can the patient stand up a little bit faster than they could before? Or do they not continue to decline? Does the disease stabilize? And stabilization is often the point that we're at right now with these gene therapies. Can we stop the progression of the disease? That's, for a lot of drugs, enough to get it approved.
Yeah, which I think, like, you can even look at MS patients. Like, that's definitely what they want to do, especially if it's a progressive form of MS. You really just want to make it, okay, can we just stop it from getting worse? Same with dementia or Alzheimer's. You know, you just don't want it to get any worse. It's so challenging. When you were talking about from beginning to getting to the FDA and the clinical trials, is there a time frame that it takes to go from A to clinical trials?
Like usual, the answer is it depends.
Yeah.
It depends on the population size of the disease. You can sort of think of it as, you know, you're designing a Swiss Army knife. Does a Swiss Army knife need to be able to treat, you know, 1,000 patients, 10,000 patients, 1,000,000 patients, that answer will impact how quickly you can get to the clinical trial. Because if you're just trying to treat one patient,
right,
you're not cutting corners on safety, but the Swiss Army knife needs to do one thing. It doesn't need to do 7 different things, although it's for the same disease. You know, it needs to treat one manifestation of one disease, which simplifies things a little bit.
Was it a quick turnaround for Terry, or was it a few years?
It was a few years. Quick is a relative term. We knew we were facing the sort of business end of a declining situation. And so the therapeutic was developed in like early 2019. And then we ended up getting approval for the clinical trial in middle of 22. So yeah. I guess 2.5-3 years, give or take.
And so he tried the clinical trial. There were complications from that.
Yeah. So at the time we started the clinical trial, we had FDA approval and all the approvals that, you know, one would need, especially Terry's approval. At that point, the disease was very much still in the late stage of the disease. Terry wasn't able to walk. He could not easily move his hands, his arms. And there was a lot of cardiopulmonary problems associated with the disease at that point. So, you know, unfortunately, it's a situation of too little too late for Terry. Mm-hmm. And so he ended up passing away in October of 2022.
And I'm sorry about that. It must have been so hard for you. You worked so hard to try to help him. Has your research and what you did for Terry, has it helped anybody else? Have you gotten farther in any kind of trials for someone with the same kind of rare disease that your brother had?
Yeah, very much so. What basically was I guess the first comment is life is neither fair nor just. I think these things are very much so artificial concepts that we as people think are real, but are in no way real. And so for Terry, the benefit, you know, that his sacrifice offered to others was this idea of now we actually have a framework to treat ultra rare disease patients. When I started this, people were like, that's crazy. That'll never work. You can't develop a drug for a single person. You need a big pharma company to do this. The FDA will never approve it. You know, all the yeah buts you could imagine, you know, were proven wrong, I would say. I think the FDA was supportive in this effort. They were collaborative in this effort. The research we worked with, it is possible to develop a drug even for a single person. And there's been other cases of that sense. And so the framework that we developed for Terry is one that is actively helping others, in fact, in the Connecticut community. And so, you know, this idea that was born with Terry is something that lives on as his legacy.
That's a beautiful thing. I mean, you know, you tried to help your brother, but you're helping other people. And so where do you see yourself in like the next 10 years?
We just finished renovating our lab in Woodbridge, Connecticut. It's a beautiful, you know, 30,000 or 25,000 square foot lab that currently hiring a few folks and we're moving into a piece of that. You know, I think Connecticut needs more lab space. And so that's a big initiative of ours is how do we get more lab space online? Not only to enable the research we do, but also to enable the ecosystem in the state. You know, I think Connecticut's particularly well positioned because of its proximity to New York, to Boston, its accessibility, the sort of not being priced out for the average person, the same as they would be priced out in New York or Massachusetts, where the cost of living is much higher. We've got great academic institutes with Yale, with UConn, with Quinnipiac and others in the state. You know, I think the state itself is starting to try to focus more on how do we encourage life science to be here. You know, you've got great organizations like BioCT who are helping to support, you know, the growth of the ecosystem. We do need more state support, though. We do need the legislature to, you know, incentivize companies to move to Connecticut. Financial and policy incentives that really make Connecticut the place, that's sort of no-brainer place to be. And I think that's starting to happen. I think we start to see, you know, the growth of startups here. We certainly need more established companies here because at the end of the day, commercial startups sell to pharmaceutical companies. And so, you know, we need the quote unquote, the buyers in the state. It takes time, but I think Connecticut's really, really well positioned to be, you know, the next miracle of Massachusetts. It'll take time. It'll take determination and focus, but with with the support of the legislature, we should be able to get there.
How important are programs like Connecticut Paid Leave to patients and to their caregivers? How do you see this fitting in to people that you work with?
Yeah, programs like these are essential, right? You know, we talked a little bit about the 5-year on average diagnostic journey that these rare disease patients go through. What that 5 years is made up of is a lot of doctor visits. And so those doctor visits require mom or dad or mom and, you know, whatever sort of construct, you know, the patient's dealing with to go to those doctor visits. Because oftentimes a rare disease is a pediatric rare disease. I think the number is about a third of rare disease patients are under 5 years old, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. And so, you know, you're not going to have a 4-year-old driving themselves to the doctor at the end of the day. So for the ability to have a flexible schedule is paramount to not only a diagnosis, but treatment, right? You know, if you're diagnosed with a disease that's treatable, oftentimes the treatments are chronic. And even if they're one-time treatments, like we see with some gene therapies, you know, the follow-up visits, the amount of time that's required to go and spend time in the doctor's office, whether it be in Connecticut or potentially, you know, on the other side of the country is really big. And it puts a really, really big impact on families. And so, you know, this concept of and this practical program of paid leave is essential to these families. This is not, you know, families sitting at home and enjoying benefits. This is families fighting for their kids' lives or their own lives. So it's really important.
The caregiver aspect of it is vital.
Huge. Yeah. Things like caregivers wildly involved. There's things like caregiver burnout. So it's not just the patient. It's, you know, if you're taking care of somebody, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you do it out of love, but there is a physical limit of, geez, I am tired. I am physically exhausted. And, you know, even the best of us can reach that point.
Yeah. And not having to choose between your job and taking care of your kid, like that's an impossible position. You know, that's not even a question. What are you going to do? You're going to want to take care of your child. So having caregiver leave.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not like, I mean, you'd rather not have this diagnosis,
right?
You know, it's not as though this is the greener side of the fence. This is not the positive side of the fence to be on. You know, these are families that not only do they sort of have the mental and physical burden that, you know, we all have, right? It's a tough world. It's a tough economy. You know, life is not easy. But on top of that, they have the very real threat of losing a loved one.
Yeah, and their job. I mean, you know.
And their job, right.
And
you got to pay the mortgage. You got to pay the utility bills.
Everything.
You got to get food on the table. And moreover, it's not just the essentials that you know, the average person has to pay for. A lot of these medications, a lot of these, you know, physical therapy, insurance doesn't cover it all. And so a lot of these expenses are out of pocket on behalf of the family. You know, doctors that are out of network or the million different hoops you have to run through to deal with insurance companies. A lot of this is paid out of pocket by families, because if you have to fight with insurance for 9 months to get a lift on your wheelchair, which is just insane, that you obviously need, but you have to fight, you know, 17 different battles to get, you know, there's a real cost to that. It's a time cost. And at the end of the day, if the insurance, you know, is unwilling at the end of the day, despite, you know, numerous appeals and by the patient, by the clinician, who all say, yeah, we need this. And the insurance says, you know, no, then the patient still needs it.
And the mental health aspect of it, you know, going through
huge.
The rare disease aspect of it and fighting for this, it's a lot. And so
it is.
I think that's a really important aspect that we also give. So thank you for that. I would love to get all the information that you need for any families that you come in contact with in Connecticut. We'd love to help them.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the end of the day, it's a bipartisan issue. This isn't sort of, it shouldn't be anyway, an issue of, you know, what party. I think rare disease cuts across the population without regard for socioeconomics, without the regard for politics. So, you know, simply because you today don't find yourself, you, the general, you don't find yourself in a position of being impacted by a rare disease, it doesn't mean that tomorrow you won't. And that's why things like these paid leave and other support programs are really necessary, because it helps people in ways that, you know, are often overlooked and neglected.
What advice would you give to a family that is in the beginning throes of having a diagnosis of a rare disease?
Ooh, I think the first thing is take a breath. I think the challenge of a rare disease diagnosis is it feels like the world is falling apart all at the same time. It puts stress on the relationship. It puts stress on the community. It puts stress on everything. And so I think the first thing is, you know, take a deep breath. I don't know that it's going to be okay, frankly, but I think the tools and technology exist today where we can, in theory, take a pretty good shot at trying to treat that disease. Is it a guarantee? Absolutely not. Is it a hard battle and war? Absolutely. But at least it's better than it was 30 years ago, where if you had a diagnosis, gene editing didn't exist. Gene replacement didn't exist. Antisense oligo, a lot of these technologies that we see coming online today for diseases like spinal muscular atrophy, they just didn't exist. And so the lessons we've learned from treating those diseases, although not perfect, are informing the treatment of other diseases today. And so I think while, you know, if I just got a diagnosis, that wouldn't make me feel incredibly better. I think after taking a deep breath and starting to think, okay, what could be done about this? What is being done about this? Hopefully give some solace. I think the other thing is pull your community in. You know, I think the burden of a rare disease, it's not easy, but it makes it easier to share it when you have people to share it with. Even if that's just being like, man, today sucks. It's something. So yeah. Keep your community close. Take one day at a time. Do your homework. Find the experts in the field. Talk to everybody. You know, it's easy to have a conversation and develop a perspective. Don't take things for granted, even whether it's, you know, where the disease is today, or, you know, burying your head in the sand of this won't happen to me. You know, I think it's a tough battle, but keep your community close, do your homework, and breathe.
Well, Rich Horgan, the founder of Cure Rare Disease, thank you so much for being on the podcast and shedding so much light on rare diseases. And I really appreciate you being honest and open and talking about your own personal experiences with Terry. I think, you know, that resonates with people who might be going through the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I thank you again for the opportunity to share. You know, if folks want to learn more, I'd encourage them to reach out at curerarediseases.org. You know, our community is really comprised of people who are all pointed in the same direction and trying to change the outcome here. So thank you. And, you know, I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, continue good luck and all of the good stuff that you're doing. It's really amazing, Rich. For more information or to apply for benefits, you can go to ctpaidleave.org. This has been another edition of the Paid Leave Podcast. Please like and subscribe so you'll be notified about new podcasts that become available. Connecticut Paid Leave is a public act with a personal purpose. I'm Nancy Barrow, and thanks for listening.